And ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 12 of the Porchcast. We are broadcasting from Spangalang Brewery here in Denver, Colorado. It's been a long time since we last recorded.
It's been a very long time since all three of us have been together.
It's true. Things have been happening. What was the last podcast that we did?
Wershkuka,
that's right. That was kind of a crazy one. And we've got a live crowd here. We've got a studio audience.
Hello!
And today we are joined by Alex and Bethany from now Pasteur Street Brewing in Vietnam, actually. And you guys want to say hi real quick?
Hey!
Hi, Porch Drinking.
It's really incredible that the light rail like goes all the way out there.
Yeah!
We've got a jam-packed session today. Like we mentioned before, Alex and Bethany from Pasteur Street, and also Taylor Reese from Spanglang, one of the co-founders, also formerly of Great Divide Brewery.
Hello, everybody.
And we've got our full cast of co-hosts today. Justin, Sam, say hi real quick. Hello.
Hello. And we're recording at Spanglang.
We are recording at Spanglang. Where is Spanglang located?
For those of you looking to find it, it's at 2736 Welton Street in the Five Points neighborhood of Denver, Colorado.
That's right. Spanglang is one of those waves of new breweries that have joined us in 2015, and it's been cranking out some fantastic beers. But we'll get to that and more later on. But let's start with Alex and Bethany. How are you guys doing today?
Doing well.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us. This is definitely a unique situation. I don't think we've had any brewers who are brewing overseas on the show with us yet. So
feels good to be the first.
Yeah, great to be here. Totally. So tell us a little bit about yourselves. How did you all get from, I know that you all started at Upslope originally, and now Vietnam, you all opened, I believe, was it Christmas Day?
It was January 2nd.
January 2nd.
We were planning for Christmas Day, but...
Felt right because our first brew was on Thanksgiving Day, so we thought it might be fun to open on Christmas Day, but just couldn't get all the pieces put together. It took us an extra week.
All right, well, let's start at the beginning. Upslope, how did you all start at Upslope? You know, you all helped to, I believe it was 2009, was that when you started brewing?
Yeah. In 2009, I moved here from Tennessee, and I was a brewer there and really wanted to be in Denver. I saw it as like the center of like the brewing community. Well, there's a lot of opportunity, so moved up here with no job and just kind of spiraled around from Denver, going all the way up to Fort Collins, Colorado Springs, dropping off resumes and seeing what happened. I got a call back from Upslope, and you know, it just seemed like the right fit. They were a small brewery at the time, brewing like seven barrel batches maybe twice a week, and they were just getting to the point where they needed some help on the brew house. It seemed like a good fit.
Had you just been self-taught up to that point?
Yeah, I was a home brewer, as most brewers are before they start working professionally, and then I got a job at Smoky Mountain Brewery in Knoxville, Tennessee, and their brewmaster was just amazing. He had been training brewers for, I guess, 20 years now. He's been in the craft beer scene since the late 70s. So, yeah, German trained, and learned a lot over there, and then I also have a degree in microbiology.
Fantastic. Melanie, were you involved with Upslope as well?
I was. I worked there only for about 2 years, started out in the tasting room, worked up to event coordinator, but I got there because I used to actually work at a bakery down the street, so I'd always trade the pastries for free beer, and when I found out they were opening their second location, I was like, oh, well, here's my resume, don't worry, it's right under their croissant, no problem, and I was actually the first person they hired when they opened the new tasting room.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I know Upslope is getting ready, they're getting prepped for their Get Down Fest, which is happening in the second week of May, I believe. It's a big music festival and beer festival. It's open to the public. People are welcome to join. So definitely check out Upslope Brewing, second weekend in May. And
a free event.
It's a free event as well, which is pretty rad. But let's get back to your all story. Alex, I know that you kind of helped develop the recipes for the pumpkin, the infamous pumpkin beer that Upslope make, as well as the Thai White IPA, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Tell us a little bit about that process, and both of those beers are phenomenal, so I'd love to hear a little bit about your perspective.
Both of those beers started off, at our Lee Hill facility, so they both started there, kind of, very, very small batches of pumpkin. We actually did 5-gallon batches of, because I had never brewed pumpkin beer before.
And
I just didn't really know what to expect as far as, you know, technical issues with our water ton or our spice blend. So that was one of the things that I found out very quickly, that the spice blend is really where it was at for these pumpkin beers. And we first went to the store and bought pumpkin spice blend for a pint. And they just added it in there. We're like, it was astringent. It just didn't have the flavor. So I called an expert, went down to Savory Spice Shop, got his input. Dan down there at the Boulder Shop, awesome guy. And he put together a spice blend for the pumpkin beer. And I think that was really what took it to the next level, as well as the first pumpkin.
What year was that?
It's 2010.
Okay. Nice. And now, you know, you all had great success at Upslope. You all had this really great situation going. Upslope's been growing and growing. The second brewery is really beautiful and phenomenal. How did you all get to the point where you're like, all right, we're going to uproot everything. We're going to go start a new brewery in Vietnam. And Vietnam, of all places.
Yeah.
It just happened across a very fall-in-the-lap kind of opportunity. Founder of Pasture Street, John Reed, his brother lives in Longmont, and he was out here visiting and kind of looking for a brewer. Had kind of all of the ducks in a line to get everything started at the brewery.
I actually start up the brewery in terms of operations.
In terms of mainly just investment and business plan. And then I just happened to meet him because I was working behind the bar at Upslope and thought his ideas sounded great and really interesting.
Sure.
So I had to introduce him to Alex, and they hit it off really well. And within about 12 hours of meeting him, we discussed it over dinner or whatever. And we're like, okay, let's move to Vietnam. Why not?
Yeah, it was a pretty snap decision. It was.
Have you ever been to Vietnam before?
No, I knew nothing about Vietnam.
Or Asia in general. Our first time to Asia, our first time pretty much
crazy
traveling abroad outside of just islands, you know, like in the Caribbean.
Yeah, and this is totally just because I don't know. Are you guys a couple? Or
Yeah.
I didn't know if you were just like business partners or if this was like romance too. Was that hard then to move overseas without any ideas?
Oh, it is very difficult. I think we were just talking about this yesterday, though. John was great. Great tour guide. He's lived in Vietnam for 6 years. He was a hospitality manager down there and just kind of knew all the ins and outs. He knows where to go get food, knows where to find a place to live, can help teach us some basic Vietnamese and kind of get us on our feet, you know, get us on a motorbike and get mobile and
wear it up.
We're in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City.
About 9 million people.
Oh,
Now, I know that John's not here to really tell his side of the story, but, like, how did, I guess, when it came to deciding he wanted to start a brewery, like, what was his thoughts of, like, wanting to start a craft brewery in Vietnam?
His brother lives in Longmont, so he had been kind of exposed to the craft beer scene as it's been growing up over these past 6 years. And, he was trying to order beer one day. He was trying to get this craft beer into one of his venues down there in Vietnam. He couldn't find a distributor, couldn't find anybody importing it. There was no American-style craft brewery, so he just had the idea, well, maybe I should just make it. And I think after a couple of years of trying to find this beer and it not being available, he thought, there's probably other people thinking the same thing, and it could be a successful business.
How long are you guys visiting on this trip now, or are you just...
This is actually our first trip back to America after 8 months of living there, and we started out in Portland for Craft Brewers Conference, Tennessee to visit Alex's family, and now Colorado to visit my family and our friends.
Cool.
It's been a whirlwind trip.
Yeah. About 3.5 weeks total. Headed back to Vietnam on Monday.
Nice. You all decide, you make the decision to move to Vietnam and start this brewery with John Reed. You know, what concept did you all have in mind? I feel like craft beer is not too big out there yet. So, you know, what was the balance like in terms of educating the palates of people out there who aren't maybe as exposed to flavors that we're so familiar with out here? And also still trying to maintain your creative freedom of exploring and creating new things that you personally like drinking.
Yeah, I think I'll let Bethany speak to the palate training. She's been training our tasting room staff and dealing with a lot of the customer interaction. And then as far as the the recipes and the beer that we're brewing out there, we really wanted to have a sense of place. We didn't want to just be importing barley into Vietnam, importing hops into Vietnam, brewing beer, and then exporting it. It doesn't seem like, why are you in Saigon at that point? So we really try and brew beers that pair well with the Vietnamese food and use local ingredients in all of our beers. So all of our beers will have some sort of non-traditional brewing ingredient that we think really... you know, highlights an aspect of Vietnamese agriculture.
What are some of those ingredients?
We do our IPA with jasmine. We do imperial stout with chocolate, cinnamon, vanilla.
Cool.
We do a series of American wheat beers where we just infuse whatever's in season. We've done rambutan. Well, that was in our kettle sour.
Yeah,
we did
passion fruit,
jackfruit.
And then our saison has black pepper and fresh lemongrass in it as well.
Whoa.
That's
it's one of the best parts of being able to find these ingredients at a market just as fresh as you could possibly get. Everything is driven in from the countryside daily, and then as we brew more of the beers, we're able to source individual farms for each of these products. So we could get coffee specifically from one region of Vietnam, or get, you know, our chocolate from a specific grove of trees.
And what's it like with the farmers? Do many of them try your beers and see their ingredients kind of being highlighted in these beers?
We haven't got any of the beers out to the farmers yet.
Okay.
But that'll definitely be happening in the future.
Yeah, that seems really cool.
Up till now, I mean, we've only had beer being served for 3 months. So, you know, a lot of this kind of sourcing of ingredients is before we even had stuff ready to serve. It was kind of the research phase. We were going out and finding these ingredients.
What are your favorite and least favorite things about living in a city with 9 million people? I'm kind of changing the subject, but...
Okay, let's see. Favorite has got to be food.
Yeah, I mean, the pho and banh mi is pretty great.
And a close second is riding a motorbike.
Yeah.
It's absolutely insane.
Do you ever strap a cake onto the motorbike?
That has happened before.
Is that the main source of transportation? For most people.
Now we have...
We have most people out in Vietnam.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's 6 million motorbikes in the city.
Wow. That's amazing. Wow. Who takes a motorbike census?
What's that?
Who takes a motorbike census?
Yeah. Just the same people that take bicycle census in Amsterdam.
Well, and that's only the registered motorbikes as well. So there's probably another 700,000 or so that are just kind of...
So we touched on this before, but tell me a little bit about the education. You know, what's the palate like? What's the culture been? And I know that when I've traveled to Asia, most of the beer that I've tried has been very watered down. You know, very light lagers. What kind of challenges do you all face in that arena? And how has the education front been so far?
It's been very interesting so far. It's similar in Vietnam, all light lagers, and they all cost a dollar or less for a 12-ounce can or anything like that. So our beer is priced as a normal American craft brewery, so it's kind of getting them used to the price point is almost more difficult than getting them used to the beer itself. But once they kind of get over that hump, especially since we have a lot of flavors that they're already used to and grew up with as far as like the fruits and coffee and chocolate, they really like it, and IPA is one of the most popular so far, which is really cool to see. They don't really know anything about hops or anything like that, so it's cool to kind of do that, and it's been really fun for me to train all of our bar staff on like how to properly pour a beer, and this is the brewing process, and all of that, because I've never worked with anyone before that doesn't have that basic level of knowledge about craft beer.
It's like a blank canvas every sense.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So it works out really nice.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Who's in there? Is it for the expats or are there local folks?
It's a mix. I'd say most of our customers right now are expats, people that are familiar with the craft beer scene. They've just been missing it.
Yeah.
They're living in Saigon because of, you know, their job transferred them or, you know, business opportunity, and they just miss that craft beer scene. So even our tasting room is set up to have the feel of an American craft brewery. A long bar, lots of people having conversations, no television, stuff like that.
Do you have television or you don't?
No. But sorry, I just lost my train of thought. What were you saying?
No, that answered it. Yeah. I was just wondering.
Expats.
Such a new idea there. I would kill for that.
What is the typical bar setup in Vietnam look like?
You wouldn't sit at the bar typically. You'd sit at a table, and you'd have a waitress. And then if you're at the bar, draft beer is relatively popular, but there's quite a bit of bottle drinking.
I think that if you were to try
to smell nice,
I think you'd smell nice too. Now, if you were to kind of tell. If someone were to visit your brewery for the first time, what are you trying to get across? What's kind of the main message that you all want to send to people who stop into Pasteur Street?
We'd like to just show that we're brewing American-style craft beers with this Vietnamese influence. We think it's a really unique opportunity to get these ingredients as fresh as you possibly can at the source. And then it's also a great opportunity to get to spread the taste of craft beer with a population of 86 million people that have never tried that before. It's kind of like wide open opportunities. There's not many expectations on what you should be brewing because there's no precedent for it there. So it's kind of this fun playing around and seeing what people like and exposing.
It's interesting. I feel like hearing you describe these ingredients that are so indigenous to that region is very similar to like the farm to table movement out here that's been really. Growing, I know that that's pretty commonplace in the brewing industry, but it's even more, I feel like it's exacerbated by these kind of unique flavors and unique fruits and whatnot, and spices that are available to you all. It's definitely kind of like farm to glass, in a sense. I don't know.
And it's also a really great way to transport those flavors. If we ever decide to get export back over here to America, you're not going to get that passion fruit flavor or that orangutan or jackfruit flavor.
The lemongrass.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing.
You're not going to get it the same if you just try to import the fruit over here. It's a really unique
so
way to try it and get a new flavor.
Preserve that flavor in the beer and send it back over.
Now, let's move on to our second guest.
Spangling!
So, kind of along the same vein of brewers uprooting themselves.
Can we swap positions here, actually?
Kind of in the same vein of brewers kind of uprooting themselves from what they're familiar with, what they're comfortable with. Taylor Reese is the perfect example of that situation because, like Alex, he was at a very prominent and distinguished brewery here in Colorado, decided to change things up and start up his own brewery. And so now he's in a completely different situation here with Spangling, which just opened just a few weeks ago.
Yep, that's correct. We opened April 9th, and it is very different from Great Divide. Great Divide is a packaging brewery. I think this year they might do well over 40,000 barrels. We're hoping to do 500 our first year. So it's definitely a different ballgame.
Cool. So, first of all, how long have you been with Great Divide?
I was with Great Divide for for 10 years. And I make the same mistake of saying I have been.
Yeah.
But, yes, I was there for 10 years. So it was, kind of a long haul as far as the industry goes. I started out on the bottling line and did a couple other tasks there. I was in racking, warehousing, logistics, and then 2-3 years into it, there was a brewer, and the brewer moved on, and I applied for the job, and Brian Dunn, the owner, was nice enough to let me have it, so I ended up, I was a brewer there for the last 7 years, and I was the head brewer for the last 4 or so years that I was there.
Nice. So how did you transition, how did this decision come about to start something completely new, and how did you decide on this location?
Well, the decision to start something new was kind of, it had been in the mind of myself and one of the other owners, Austin Wiley, for a couple years. We actually had a completed business plan probably 3 years ago, and we had kind of been quietly working on trying to find financing just because we were both. At the time, Austin was also employed with Great Divide, and then he was at Denver Beer Co. for a year before this. So it was tricky, but we had to try and find financing without really telling a lot of people we were looking for it because we needed our jobs and didn't want to upset anyone, but finally we came across another great Divide employee. Darren Boyd is the third partner, and we knew he had been looking to start a brewery, and he had access to the one thing we didn't have, which was funds. So he was able to, he knew the right people to secure those. So the three of us kind of put our heads together and started working towards this. As far as this location goes, we hadn't necessarily, we loved Five Points. We wanted to be in Five Points, but our real estate agent at the time, or I guess he still would be, but he found out about the people that bought this property. For those of you, most of you probably don't know this, this is a DMV. So anyone who's from Denver knows this as the Five Points DMV. It was a DMV for like 15 years.
I've had many, many miserable hours spent here trying to update my registration.
Exactly.
And whatnot,
so it was a place that most people did not want to go to. But about a year and a half ago, the owners decided they wanted to sell. The people that bought the property wanted Brewers as their anchor tenant. They bought this whole plaza. There's a couple other buildings involved, but and our real estate agent kind of made it all happen. So we signed the lease in August 1st, and there was, you know, build out from then until now, and we're open.
Go ahead. So, at what point did you leave Great Divide and start making this your full? Put your full attention towards this.
The day after we signed the lease. You know, we had the hard task of telling our employers that we were going to be moving on. And then...
three of you?
Well, Austin at the time was at Denver Beer Co., so we had to do the same thing with them. But
did they see it coming at all?
I don't know about the other guys. I don't think they saw it coming with me. Because, I, you know, and I love Great Divide. I still love drinking their beer, but I loved working there. I wasn't trying to get away from anything. Yeah.
It wasn't like,
it's not like I was trying to, I didn't like Great Divide. This was just something I really wanted to do, and the opportunity was so great.
Sure.
So.
It's funny because I recently visited with the guys over at Call to Arms Brewing, which is going to be opening this summer.
Those are awesome guys.
Many of them all worked at Avery, and they were in a similar situation of, you know, they love working at Avery. It's a great place to work, but, you know, they described it as having no limits aside from their own creativity when it comes to the, when they have the opportunity to start their own brewery, the only limit was their own creativity.
So there's some of that. I think Great Divide does, their creativity is great. There's definitely something about the fact that you're making your own decisions and you're reaping the consequences of those decisions,
sure,
whether they're good or bad, and that was exciting. It's one huge thing for us, all of us. Breweries like Great Divide and Avery have to spend, and New Belgium, they spend enormous amounts of money and time with quality.
Sure.
Quality assurance, quality control. So they're taking this beer, sending it all over the country, and they have to take great precautions to make sure that it's still
consistent.
In its consistent, great state when it arrives.
Absolutely.
In whatever state it's going to arrive in. And that's awesome. But one thing we were excited about was the tight control over quality here in a place like this, because we have no intention of packaging it ever.
Yeah.
The fact that we can serve the beer to our customers right over the bar, we can taste it as it's going to them, make sure the glassware is perfect, make sure the experience is great. That for us was kind of exciting. It's kind of a cop out because it's much easier than a packaging brewery, you know. But at the same time, we really like that, and that kind of frees us up to focus on other things. So we were excited about that aspect. That was a huge thing for all of us. I had enormous amounts of stress at Great Divide, just worrying about what was happening to beer once it left the brewery. And I think any brewer at a packaging brewery probably feels the same thing. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. You spend a lot of time making sure that your beer is going to taste exactly the same. And then when you get down to that smaller level, you worry about what it's going to taste like, not just making it consistent. So,
exactly.
You get to play around with flavors a little bit more often. That's just part of being smaller. You're more flexible. You're more nimble. And, you know, hopefully at Pasteur Street we grow and we get to that point, because our intentions are to be a packaging brewery. But You know, it's a different mindset when you've been kind of doing that job where it's very stressful and it's all quality-centric as it needs to be. It's kind of almost relaxing, you know.
Yeah,
in a way to get out and play around with the recipes once again.
Yeah, exactly. And if, you know, it's a smaller scale, so if something doesn't turn out right, you can, I suppose we can dump it. And you can do that at a big, and any, you know, all big breweries, they're never going to let bad product go out the door, but there's just some freedom there. That being said, I just want to say I want breweries to keep packaging because that is what I drink when I'm at home.
Yeah.
And I need other people to be really stressed out about
sure.
that.
Yeah.
And I want them to keep doing that so that I can keep drinking that beer at home. I think it's incredibly difficult. But anyways, those were kind of our motivations. Creativity is one, for
yeah.
sure. That was probably a really long answer to a short question. But
yeah. And I understand that Spangling has a lot of, really embraces the history of kind of this region and also, you know, the historical side of Five Points
yep.
as a whole. Can you tell us a little bit more, also
yep.
going into the name, right?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So to start off, the Five Points neighborhood of Denver has a very rich history, and a lot of it is revolved around jazz culture, and a lot of it took place in the 30s, 40s, 50s. A ton of jazz musicians came through this area, and this neighborhood in particular. And, you know, the reason this neighborhood was so infilled with jazz musicians is, unfortunately, on some levels, it was one of the only areas that would allow black people to rent to get hotel rooms. So they came here, they stayed at the Russonian, which is a famous hotel right down the street. And afterwards, after they'd go downtown Denver, play their shows, they'd come back down here, play more. And so the neighborhood became a hub for jazz musicians. They call it the Harlem of the West at one point. So it's got this awesome history. Jack Kerouac writes about it in On the Road. He actually references 27th and Welton, which is the cross street we are at right
That's
now.
Awesome.
So, I mean, Five Points has this amazing history. And for the last, gosh, I mean, for years, 20, 30 years, the neighborhood's kind of just been quiet. And it's always seemed like such a cool neighborhood, and we were excited to be a part of it. And when we decided to be a part of it, we also felt that the history was so cool, there's no way we could not kind of tip our hat to that, pay homage to it. So we started off by naming the brewery Spangling, which is a weird name. There were a couple reasons for the weirdness of it. First and foremost, we wanted to make sure it was a name that nobody else, we wouldn't get a cease and desist,
yeah.
you know, a month later, which,
except for Nate Theo and,
yeah. What's that? Yeah. So,
Spangling.
Yeah.
But,
this is close. Yeah. But, it's, so we wanted a name that we could comfortably trademark and not have to worry about any of that nonsense, because that's a big deal in the industry right now. And but what it is, Spanglang refers to a drum pattern. It's the idea of a drummer emphasizing the cymbal, kind of the that's Spanglang. A musician named Kenny Clark developed that, and basically the idea, jazz musicians, he developed it so that, you know, the horn players could solo, the piano players could solo over the drums without the drums being in their face. So that's where that name comes from. It came from a friend of an investor of ours, and we love it. It's grown on us.
So, is your logo?
No, I was going to say it's 5 points and
it
a symbol,
is.
Right?
So this logo is a record, and that's the 5 point intersection.
Oh,
it's a symbol. It's both those things. So yeah, that's the 5 point intersection. I can tell you what streets are which, but it's and then combined with a symbol or a record, depending on how you want to look at it. Once they're a simple circle.
Yeah. You guys, go for it.
So that's super cool. That like to learn about the name and just the tie-in with the neighborhood, like. I was actually sitting on the couch at home several months ago on a Sunday night, and my dad texted me and told me that there was a PBS special on about Neil Cassady that night, and so I flipped it over and started watching it, and that's how I learned about the Russonian and this neighborhood and like a lot of the things that are tied in with Jack Kerouac, and just kind of started doing a little more research on that, so that's super cool.
Yeah, it's a fascinating history that I don't think enough people in Denver know about. But there is a book, I think, 5 Points History of Denver. You can get it at some of the bookstores around town, but it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Have you guys gotten any pushback for bringing something that is like more of a European tradition into a neighborhood that has African-American roots? Has some kind of, like,
it's more of, right now it's more of a white thing, to be honest, if we're going to be honest about it. And yes,
almost every brewer I've ever met is white.
Yeah. And we have. And it's been minor, and it's not from the people we meet on a day-to-day basis. Our neighbors at Welton Street, our next-door neighbor, CB, he owns the dry cleaner. The actual people we've come in contact with and have come to, since we've opened the last 3 weeks, they've come and had beer. We have not had pushback from the people that actually live, I think, or have businesses on Welton Street. But online, there has been some, and I don't know who those people are, but there's definitely been some controversy, is what some bloggers have called it, but to be honest with you, we're here for the neighborhood, and that's everybody. Yeah. And we're getting everybody, which we think is awesome.
Yeah.
So we are kind of ignoring it.
It's hard to please everyone.
We don't think what we're doing is... We're trying to ingratiate ourselves. We're trying to become part of the neighborhood, part of the history, part of the culture, not trying to change it in any way. So there definitely have been some people that have problems with it, but
I think
we're
cool
just going to do the best we can. And
I mean, you're keeping the same external face.
Yeah.
You're becoming part of the neighborhood instead of imposing something external on it.
Yep. Exactly. We're just trying to kind of fit in. So it's been an issue, but we're fine with it.
In terms of your philosophy for your beers, what are you looking to get across in the beers that you're making, and how does that differentiate or maybe enhance what you had been doing previously?
So a lot of what we have all been doing previously, you know, played into what we came out with right off the bat. We had a new system to brew on, a very short timeline, so what we brewed right off the bat was stuff we liked, but also that we had a little more confidence in, so we wanted to come out with a solid lineup to start. Some might call it safe, you know, there's IPAs, there's Imperial Stouts, but...
They're all really stellar. Like, seriously, it's, you know, one of the things that I always... I hate to say judge, but whenever I visit a brewery for the first time when they first open, I really want to see whether the quality is up to par and whether they have, you know, whether they've got their ducks in a row in terms of making sure that they have enough beer, making sure that they've taken great care to make sure that the beer is ready when they're actually serving it. And I feel like, you know, we've seen that with you guys, and it, the great thing is that the class of 2015 in Denver, in particular, has all been pretty stellar, and we've seen great, great opening lineups and people who have really taken great care to take their time and open the right way. And I think you all are a perfect example of that.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice of you to say.
And that's one of the cool things about like being at a point now, a couple decades into the kind of this craft beer movement, is that there are now people that are opening up these new breweries that have been in the industry for a long time and like have worked in breweries that, you know, where quality is there and, you know, measures are put in place to make sure that, you know, the beer's good. And so like there's people that are creating these small breweries that have a lot of experience in the industry, which is great too.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so we wanted to make sure the quality was there. And so that meant, obviously, we couldn't put out a Brett beer or anything like that. I mean, we didn't have time for a lot of those beers. And we could have delayed opening 6 months, but we probably wouldn't have opened because we'd have run out of money. But so we just, you know, to start, we came out with a solid lineup that we thought was creative, stuff we were pretty familiar with brewing from our previous jobs. And then from now, it's going to be just... fun, you know. Now that we've got some inventory and we're comfortable that we're not going to run out of beer, that was another concern. We had no idea really where we'd be at, but we think we're good. So we're starting to play around with acid a little bit. We did a kettle sour last week. We've got some beers that are going into barrels, and we're going to add some Brett. So we're going to start doing some fun stuff now that we kind of got our feet under us. And so as far as what's going to define us, we're just hoping we can be a really nice spot for the neighborhood. And we're going to experiment. We're going to do what we can. But probably we'll always see some IPAs from us because we're all hopheads. And there'll be probably a pretty Belgian-heavy lineup.
Cool.
From there, you know, we'll do everything. We'll get into lagers once we're, you know, make sure we can take up 3 months of tank time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's going to be, you know, we're just trying to make great beer. And
fantastic. Well, thanks so much for hosting us. We're going to move on to our next segment, which is going to be, I've got kind of a game that I've got set up. I actually did more preparation for this show than I think we've ever done before. So we've got a few extra guests who are listening, and we're going to have them participate in this game as well. You guys want to introduce yourselves real quick?
My name's Aaron. I just moved here 6 weeks ago from Seattle. New to Denver.
I have no voice, but my name is Shauna. I've lived here for a few years.
I'm Molly. I'm visiting from Madison, Wisconsin.
So, I thought it'd be kind of fun. Porch drinking has always been about conversation, and like we incorporate pop culture and sports and a little bit. So, this weekend is going to be the Kentucky Derby, and when you hear this, the Derby will be over already. But we, in true porch drinking, porch cast fashion, we like to do things a little bit late. And so, I've got the names of some Kentucky Derby horses. And also I came up with some other names that aren't necessarily names of horses. And I'm going to go around and see if I'm going to give you a name, and you're going to tell me actual Kentucky Derby horse or something else. So we'll start with Molly. Why don't we start with Molly? We'll go around in a circle. Why don't we turn this kind of her way first? Molly, your first horse, or perhaps something else, is Ocho, Ocho, Ocho. Is that the name of a Kentucky Derby horse, or just something that I made up?
Ocho, Ocho, Ocho.
Yes.
Trace Ocho. I'm going to say you made that up.
That is actually a Kentucky
Derby horse. No!
Yes. All right.
It's a great name.
Yes, all right. Next up, Carpe Diem. Is that the name of a Kentucky Derby horse, or just something that we made up?
Risky is a horse.
Are you sure?
Yes,
final
I'm
answer.
Sure.
Alright, that is actually the name of a horse in the Kentucky Derby this year. Alright, Aaron, you are from Kentucky. A lot of pressure.
We're gonna bring that up.
And again, these are horses that are in this year's Derby, so it's not gonna be a past Derby horse. Okay. Eclipse. Eclipse. Is that the name of a Kentucky Derby horse in this year's Derby, or something else?
Something else.
Something else? All right. That is correct. Something
Yay!
Else. All right.
Yeah, right.
Sam.
Oh.
Sam Pike. Sam Pike is up. We've got Love Buzz. Is that the name of
Buzz or Buzz?
Buzz. Buzz. Love Buzz.
That changes it.
Yeah.
Yeah, not only is Love Buzz a horse, but Love Buzz has been famed for kind of bringing this small town in Virginia together around, like, its breeding process. The mayor was there during its conception. A priest blessed the foal as it exited its mama. And then, I mean, the whole educational system grew up on this horse. They brought it into schools. They taught.
All right, we're gonna stop it right there. This is Love Buzz is actually not a horse in this year's Kentucky Derby. So very, very true to form. Sam Pike coming up with great stories for a non-existent horse.
Some might call them lies. Some might call them stories.
Yes. All right. Next up, we've got Dortmund. Justin Patty Dortmund.
I'm going to say not a horse.
Not a horse. It is actually a horse in the Kentucky Derby.
I thought they usually had
Dortmund,
two or three names.
Yeah, you know.
Every once in a while they get crazy and give it just a two-syllable, one-word name.
All right, Taylor. Taylor, you are up next. Yeah. American Pharoah. American Pharoah.
American Pharoah. I'm going to call that a horse.
That
I think it's 32-1 to win.
All right, you
just
got
kidding.
It. American Pharoah is actually a horse. Well done. All right, Alex, you're up next. Serendipity.
That's not a horse.
It's not a horse.
Too
you're right.
Too
All right.
Too much
All right.
Of a horse.
Bethany, finally.
All right.
Snowden.
Not a horse.
Not a horse. All right. Well done. That is not a horse. Well done. All right. So, a little twist to all of this. The ones that were not actually horses were names of beers. So, snowed in, copper kettle. Eclipse was from 5050. Serendipity is from New Glarus. So, and then the rest were all actual horses. So,
are you sure those horse names are not also beer names, though, too?
That's a really good point. Because
they could be, but they are actually horses in the Kentucky
Ocho,
Derby.
Ocho, Ocho.
So, yeah. We
trademark that. Somebody trademark that.
There is a Dortmunder Gold from Great Lakes. Yeah. So that is actually the name of a beer, but Dortmund, Dortmund is a horse in the Derby this year. But yeah, I think we've had a really great show. I think, you know, it's really great to hear your all stories and how you've gone these big transitions, and we're really excited for both of your all's projects. So,
appreciate it.
Thank you all so much for coming on. And we also always end the show with a question. So we've got a question. We're hoping to publish this on May the 4th, which is Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. So we're going to go around real quick, I want to ask you all, we always end with a question, what is your favorite Star Wars memory or character or something Star Wars related? What is your favorite aspect of Star Wars? Because we are huge dorks, and Taylor, why don't you start us off?
Oh, that's awesome. I don't have a whole lot of Star Wars memories, I'll be honest with you.
Okay.
Chewbacca, maybe.
All right.
I have more Spaceball memories.
Yeah, yes. Okay, so give us the Spaceball.
Yes.
Well, I watched that movie over and over again when I was in middle school, and I thought it was genius. So, and that was probably where most of my knowledge of Star Wars came from, however incorrect that might be.
Yes.
So I'm sorry I don't have
jamming the radars.
Yeah. Jamming the radars. What was his name?
Lone Star.
No, the name of the actor, Darth Vader.
Rick Moranis.
Rick Moranis. Yeah, yeah.
I was about to call him Greg Louganis.
Completely different people.
Rick Moranis. But I wish I had a better answer for him. Sorry.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah, I might be in the same boat here. Not a huge Star Wars fan.
Oh, man, it's rare that we're in a room with people who do not embrace the wars.
Right. Chewbacca. Yeah, I'll go with that one.
All right,
yeah.
Are you any making a Chewbacca noise?
actually, I have a good story. I'm sorry. This is totally off topic. This is not kind of related to Star Wars. A friend of mine played this joke on Craigslist. This was 10 years ago when he could get away with this, and he put an ad saying he had original Star Wars figurines, and that whoever called, and that he wanted to get rid of them because his roommate left them, and he's pissed. He wants to give them away for free. They're original. So if you call this number and leave a voicemail with your best Chewbacca impression, you can have them. And he put down the number of another friend of ours. And that guy got like hundreds of people just calling his phone. And he would pick it up, or they'd leave it on voicemail and just doing a Chewbacca impression. And one guy said he had like naked Princess Leia to trade or some crazy.
My gosh.
Got really into it. Pretty crazy. But
that's fantastic.
That's a pretty funny story. Related.
It's a really great prank.
But it is a good prank if anyone needs one.
Yeah.
Nice.
All right, Bethany.
All right. Well, it's actually from about a week ago when we were in Tennessee. One of Alex's best friends from growing up is really excited for the new Star Wars. We're talking about the preview and everything like that. And I honestly haven't even seen the preview for the new Star Wars, so I don't know. But I have seen the preview for the new Jurassic Park probably about 100 times. So we split all of our friends up between Team Jurassic Park and Team Star Wars. So I'm Team Jurassic Park. I gotta go for it.
You got it. Nice.
Oh, we're doing this. Okay. My favorite Star Wars memory is when I was in sixth grade. I loved Princess Leia's buns and her hair so much that I would do it to my own hair and wore it to a sixth grade dance. And that was the first time I ever danced with a boy.
Nice.
Thank you.
Well, I actually do like Star Wars, but I never was able to see it on the big screen. because I always wanted to go with my dad, but he never went with me because he always called it crap flying through the air. So I've seen it, but never on the big screen.
Have you ever thrown crap at people?
No.
That's good.
So my favorite Star Wars memory happened in a galaxy far, 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 long, long, long time ago. When I was 10 years old, before I knew what girls were useful for, I put together models. I had little models, and I had a Millennium Falcon model that I put together, and it was probably like 300 different pieces that I glued together. And it was really sweet. That's my, and I still actually have it stored away somewhere. But it was one like whenever they were really popular, the original movies were really popular.
I'm not going to ask you what girls are used for now.
We can talk about that some other day when you're ready.
Yeah, all right, cool.
That's Tristan's other podcast.
Sam?
Yeah, Sam.
Yeah, so I don't know if you all remember, but in the beginning of Star Wars, like the first old episode, I don't think that's like episode one or whatever, but it's sometime, when Luke Skywalker is all angsty and he leaves his aunt and uncle's little house and is just like sitting out watching these two moons, well, they just had dinner and they used these weird looking glasses that looked like this Tupperware that my family had at the time because it was the 80s. And I would always take those Tupperware glasses and go sit out on my parents' deck and look at the moon and pretend I was Luke Skywalker.
That's awesome.
Good story.
That's really cool. I guess I was a big Star Wars geek, which is why I brought up the question to begin with. We formed our own Jedi Academy, and we'd take wiffle ball bats and whack each other with them as if they were lightsabers. And I named my first dog Yoda, so that was he was a beagle. He had huge ears, so it kind of made sense. But yeah, my first dog's name was Yoda.
So kind of bringing it back full circle, I saw Spaceballs way more times than I had. Like I saw it a ton of times before I ever even saw Star Wars, which I was born in the early '80s, and I was like one of the only kids of my friends that had never seen Star Wars, and I didn't see it until I was 13 or 14. And they had re-released it into the theaters. That would have been like 96 or 97, I want to say. And my dad, who was in his early 30s at that point, he had never seen it either, which was almost crazier because he would have been like a teenager when the first one came out. And so he thought it was a little bit ridiculous that he'd never seen it, and so he took us to a midnight showing at one of the theaters in Fort Collins. So that was the first and only time I've ever seen Star Wars. And I think I probably ended up sleeping through half of it because it was like 2 in the morning and I was sleeping in the theater. So I don't really know a whole lot about Star Wars. I do like that Billy Dee Williams was in those Colt 45 commercials back in the 70s. But like, yeah. Mel Brooks and Star Spaceballs is a little bit more up my alley than sure. Star Wars has ever been.
All right.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks again to Alex, Bethany, and Taylor for joining us and hosting us today.
Thanks to our live studio audience.
Audience for their fan participation. And it's really great to be amongst our hosts once again. We're going to try to get in as many podcasts as we can before June. I don't know if you're ready to...
Yeah, this is the first one.
Tell the interwebs.
The first one we've recorded since I found out that I'm moving to California. So I'll be moving to the San Francisco Bay Area, Oakland, in 2 months to work for New Belgium out there. So bittersweet, for sure.
Absolutely.
I'm excited about it, but it'll be tough to leave Denver behind. But I'll still be very much connected to Colorado through the brewery and back here frequently. I'll be back in Colorado about 4 weeks after I move out there, and yeah, so tons of family and stuff here and great friends, so I'll be back in Denver and Fort Collins regularly.
Awesome.
Yeah,
good deal.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again for tuning in, and be sure to check out Pasteur Street Brewery if you're ever in Vietnam, and also Smangalang Brewery here in Denver, Colorado. So
adios.